ॐ नमो भगवते
नारायणं नमस्कृत्य नरं चैव नरोत्तमम् देवीं सरस्वतीं व्यासं ततो जयो मुदीरयेत् नाष्टप्रयेषु अभद्रेषु नित्यं भागवत सेवया भगवाच्युतमश्लोके भक्तिर्भावते नैष्ठिके. Before reciting the Srimad Bhagavatam, which is our very means of conquest, let us offer our obeisances unto the personality of Godhead, Lord Narayan, unto Nada Narayan Rishi, the supermost human being, unto Mother Saraswati, the goddess of learning, and unto Srila Vyasadeva, the author. By regular attendance and classes on the Bhagavatam, and by rendering service to the pure devotee, all that is inauspicious within the heart is practically destroyed, and thus loving service to the personality of Godhead, who is praised with transcendental song, is established as an irrevocable fact. Om Jnanatimirandhasya Jnananjana Salakaya Chakshurunmilitam Jena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. I was born in the darkest of ignorance, and my spiritual master is forcing open my eyes with the torchlight of knowledge. I offer my humble obeisances unto him. Panchakalpa tarubhyascha kripa sindhu pyevacha patitanan pavanevyo vaishnavevyo namo namaha jai shri krishna chaitanya prabhu nityananda shri advaita gadadhara shivashadi gaurabhaktavinda hare krishna hare krishna 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 hare 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 Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Oh, it's a long section today, and it's like 6 verses, like that. And of course, I thought, oh, it's okay because I've given Bhakti my bhava a few times. Then I went to my notes last night and found I didn't. I only had a few notes. I didn't really have a lesson plan, so that was a little bit of a surprise. But I think it would be a good idea to just read through the text first, just to get the feeling. Because now we've heard about how Vyasadeva was inspired by his spiritual master to come to the point of speaking Krishna Katha, and how when one hears Krishna Katha, the sprout? It's the inclination towards devotional service sprouts up at once to extinguish the blazing fire of lamentation, ignorance, and fearfulness. Amazing, amazing. So now we're going to begin to hear the topics. And it's very interesting because these topics that we hear now are quite intense. Just like one time Prahlada Nandamaraj said, he said, you know, the Ramayana is so full of anxiety and stress. He said, but when you hear it, you become free from anxiety and stress. So when we also hear the topics of the Bhagavatam, which sometimes are a great saga, as we'll hear now, if you identify with Draupadi, you'll certainly think it's a great saga. But the Bhagavatam begins where the Mahabharat ends off, more or less, right? So now we're going to hear at the very last incidents of the Battle of Kurukshetra, and they're heartrending. But of course, there's a transcendental message involved. So in order to get the feeling of the section, I think it's worthwhile reading the whole thing. My little baby computer is dying, so I have to take this monster. Sorry. Okay. So Suta Goswami thus addressed the rishis headed by Shonaka Rishi. So you know that's the original scenario, that Shonaka Rishi is going to speak Bhagavatam. And there was some backtracking done, which is necessary to give the background of the Bhagavatam. But now he's going to go into the Bhagavatam proper. He said, now I shall begin the transcendental narration of the Lord Sri Krishna and topics of the birth, activities, and deliverance of King Parikshit, the sage among the kings, as well as topics of the renunciation of the worldly order by the sons of Pandu. So this is the contents of the first canto. So now we're going back to the end of the war. Mahabharata war, when the Pandus had won, the Pandavas had won the war, technically, although the loss of life and the carnage was devastating. When the respective warriors of both camps, namely the Kauravas and the Pandavas, were killed on the battlefield of Kurukshetra, and the dead warriors obtained their deserved destinations, and when the son of Dhritarashtra fell down lamenting, his spine broken, being beaten by the club of Bhimasena, the son of Dronacharya, Ashvatthama, beheaded the five sleeping sons of Draupadi and delivered them as a prize to his master, foolishly thinking that he would be pleased. Duryodhana, however, disapproved of the heinous act, and he was not pleased in the least. Is everybody familiar with this topic? Should I give a little background explanation? Do you know it, dear? Okay. So the war is over, and officially everything's finished. But one person was still not peaceful. So he went to the winning camp, and while the sons of the hero, the winner, was sleeping, he cut off their heads. So that was like unbelievable. There's a whole history with that that's quite interesting, but we don't have time to go into it now. So Draupadi, the mother of the five children of the Pandavas, after hearing of the massacre of her sons, began to cry in distress with eyes full of tears, trying to pacify her in great loss. Arjuna spoke. You know who Arjuna is, right? The hero of the spoke to her thus. I wish I could give you more detail, but it's such a long section. O gentle lady, when I present you with the head of that Brahmana, after beheading him with arrows from my Gandiva bow, I shall then wipe the tears from your eyes and pacify you. Then, after burning your son's bodies, you can take your bath standing on his head. This was the mood of the Kshatriyas. It gets them through. If you have to fight that much and do that much killing, you got to have some... Of course, we'll see later that Draupadi wasn't pacified. But that's this. I think by this time she'd seen enough bloodshed and war and death. And although she's a very powerful Kshatriya lady, huh? She don't. What they say, she doesn't cut any slack. Arjuna, who is guided by the infallible Lord as friend and driver, thus satisfied the dear lady by such statements. Then he dressed in armor and armed himself with furious weapons, and getting into his chariot, he set out to follow Ashvatthama, the son of his martial teacher. So Ashvatthama, who killed the sons of the Pandavas, had actually been the son of the person who had taught the Pandavas how to fight. Very close family relationship. Can you imagine? If someone from your family does something heinous, it's more painful. We've heard about this recently, right? So there was some massacre in America. And one devotee, she posted something on Facebook about, just imagine the position of the mother who had to live with this child her whole life and try to control this child. Ashvatthama, the murderer of the princes, seeing from a great distance Arjuna coming at him with great speed, fled in his chariot, panic-stricken, just to save his life, as Brahma fled in fear from Shiva. When the son of the Brahmana, Ashvatthama, saw that his horses were tired, he considered that there was no alternative for protection outside of his using the ultimate weapon, the Brahmastra, the nuclear weapon of that time. Since his life was in danger, he touched water in sanctity, like we do, we take Achman, and concentrated upon the chanting of the hymns for throwing nuclear weapons, although he did not know how to withdraw such weapons. So you can see he's really out of it, because if that weapon actually attacks, many more people can get harmed. That's the... So he really lost. Thereupon, a glaring light spread in all directions. It was so fierce that Arjuna thought his own life in danger. And so he began to address Lord Sri Krishna. This is the amazing thing. Although his own life is in danger, he says quite some prayers to Krishna. Arjuna said, "O my Lord Sri Krishna, you are the Almighty Personality of Godhead. There is no limit to your different energies. Therefore, only you are competent to instill fearlessness in the hearts of your devotees. Everyone in the flames of material miseries can find the path of liberation in you only." I wish we all had books and we could all take turns reading. You are the original personality of Godhead who expands himself all over the creations. He didn't say creation, he says creations. On Facebook recently, I put that they're realizing that there's more than... Did you see that? More than one planetary system, and there's life in other places. I couldn't help being sarcastic. I just wrote, "Duh." I mean, we already heard from the Bhagavatam a long time ago, but now they're just, with their great intelligence, figuring it out experimentally. So he's talking about the creations here. And you are the original personality of Godhead who expands himself all over the creations and are transcendental to material energy. You have cast away the effects of the material energy by dint of your spiritual potency. You are always situated in eternal bliss and transcendental knowledge. And yet, though you are beyond the purview of the material energy, you execute the four principles of liberation characterized by religion and so on for the ultimate good of the conditioned souls. So keep in mind, you know, this weapon is coming towards him as he says these prayers. So this is what you call a cliffhanger. Thus, you descend as an incarnation to remove the burden of the world and to benefit your friends, especially those who are your exclusive devotees and are wrapped in meditation upon you. O Lord of Lords, how is it that this dangerous effulgence is spreading all around? Where does it come from? I do not understand it. For Arjuna, it was inconceivable that someone would do a thing like this, so he can't even understand that it's the Brahmastra coming towards him. The Supreme Personality of Godhead said, "Know from me that this is the act of the son of Drona. He has thrown the hymns of nuclear energy, Brahmastra, and he does not know how to retract the glare. He has haplessly done this, being afraid of imminent death. O Arjuna, only another Brahmastra can counteract this weapon. Since you are expert in the military science, subdue this weapon's glare with the power of your own weapon." There has to be a movie made of this. There just has to be. Sri Suta Goswami said, "Hearing this from the personality of Godhead, Arjuna touched water for purification, and after circumambulating Lord Sri Krishna, he cast his Brahmastra weapon to counteract the other one. When the rays of the two Brahmastra combined, a great circle of fire like the disk of the sun covered all outer space and the whole firmament of planets. Thus, all the population of the three worlds was scorched by the combined heat of the weapons. Everyone was reminded of the Samvartika fire which takes place at the time of annihilation. Thus, seeing the disturbance of the great populace and the imminent of the general populace and the imminent destruction of the planets, Arjuna at once retracted both Brahmastra weapons as Lord Sri Krishna desired. Arjuna, his eyes blazing in anger like two red balls of copper, dexterously arrested the son of Gautami and bound him with ropes like an animal." You have to understand, for a kshatriya to be bound like this is like the ultimate degradation. "After binding Ashwatthama, Arjuna wanted to take him to the military camp. personality of Godhead, Sri Krishna, looking on him with his lotus eyes, spoke to angry Arjuna. Prabhupada makes a distinction in the purport that Krishna's anger and Arjuna's anger are different. Lord Sri Krishna said, O Arjuna, you should not show mercy by releasing this relative of a Brahmana, a Brahma Bandhu, for he has killed innocent boys in their sleep. A person who knows the principles of religion does not kill an enemy who is careless, intoxicated, insane, asleep, afraid, or devoid of his chariot, nor does he kill a boy, a woman, a foolish creature, or a surrendered soul. A cruel and wretched person who maintains his existence at the cost of others' lives deserves to be killed for his own well-being. Otherwise, he will go down by his own actions. Furthermore, I have personally heard you promise Draupadi that you would bring forth the head of the killer of her sons. This man is an assassin and murderer of your own family members. Not only that, but he has also dissatisfied his master. He is but the burnt remnants of his family. Kill him immediately. Krishna also doesn't cut any slack. Not with people like Ashwatthama. Srutu Goswami said, although Krishna, who was examining Arjuna in religion, encouraged Arjuna to kill the son of Dronacharya, Arjuna, a great soul, did not like the idea of killing him. This is how you realize Krishna's devotees are more merciful than him. Why? Because they know the purpose of the Lord. Although Ashwatthama was the heinous murderer of Arjuna's family relatives, after reaching his own camp, Arjuna, along with his dear friend and charioteer, Sri Krishna, entrusted the murderer unto his dear wife, who was lamenting for her murdered sons. Sri Suta Goswami said, Draupadi then saw Ashwatthama, who was bound with ropes like an animal and silent for having enacted the most inglorious murder. Due to her female nature and due to her being naturally good and well-behaved, she showed him due respects as a brahmana. Prabhupada has something to say about that. We will discuss it later. He says a few things. She could not tolerate Ashwatthama's being bound by ropes, and being a devoted lady, she said, release him, for he is a brahmana, our spiritual master. Well, Devaki did the same thing. Huh? When Kamsa was bowing down at her feet, he was begging for forgiveness after killing all her sons. And they forgave. Well, I don't get it. It's way over my heart. But she did it. Anyway, Krishna had a plan there. Therefore, he could infuse her heart with all this. And she was open for it, of course. It was by Dronacharya's mercy that you learned the military art of throwing arrows and the confidential art of controlling weapons. He, Dronacharya, is certainly still existing, being represented by his son. His wife, Kripi, did not undergo a sati with him because she had a son. O most fortunate one who knows the principles of religion, it is not good for you to cause grief to glorious family members who are always respectable and worshipable. My Lord, do not make the wife of Dronacharya cry like me. I am aggrieved for the death of my sons. She need not cry constantly like me. If the kingly administrative order, being unrestricted in sense control, offends the Brahmana order and enrages them, then the fire of that rage burns up the whole body of the royal family and brings grief upon all. Suta Goswami said, O Brahmana, King Yudhisthira fully supported the statements of the queen, which were in accordance with the principles of religion and were justified, glorious, full of mercy and equity, and without duplicity. Nakula and Sahadev, the younger brothers of the king, and also Satyaki Arjuna, the personality of Godhead, Lord Sri Krishna, the son of Devaki, and the ladies and all others unanimously agreed with the king. Who didn't agree? Who remembers? Yeah. Bhima, however, disagreed with them and recommended killing the culprit who in an angry mood had murdered sleeping children for no purpose and for neither his son nor his master's interest. Neither his nor his master's interest. I would have been on Bhima's side. Shatrubhuja, the four-armed one, or the personality of Godhead, after hearing the words of Bhima, Draupadi, and others, saw the face of his dear friend Arjuna, and he began to speak as if smiling. So Krishna has the tendency to smile when Arjuna is in difficulty, not because he's enjoying the difficulty, but he's enjoying the devotees manifesting their wonderful qualities. And Prabhupada mentions in the Purport that Krishna had to manifest four arms, because Arjuna was... Krishna had to hold back Bhima, and he had to like divide the family from doing anything, because Bhima was really angry. The personality of Godhead said, "A friend of a brahmana is not to be killed, but if he is an aggressor, he must be killed. All these rulings are in the scriptures, and you should act accordingly. You have to fulfill your promise to your wife, and you must also act to the satisfaction of Bhimasena and me." Krishna would also tell him to kill him, right? Just then, Arjuna could understand the motive of the Lord by his equivocal orders, and thus, with his sword, he severed both hair and jewel from the head of Ashvatthama. He, Ashvatthama, had already lost his bodily luster due to infanticide. Infanticide means the killing of children. And now, moreover, having lost the jewel from his head, he lost even more strength. Thus he was unbound and driven out of the camp. Cutting the hair from his head, depriving him of his wealth, and driving him from his residence are the prescribed punishments for the relatives of a brahmana. There is no injunctions for killing the body. Thereafter, the sons of Pandu and Draupadi, overwhelmed with grief, perform the proper rituals for the dead bodies of their relatives. So does everybody have a feeling for the story now? Pretty intense, huh? So when you hear these, that the Bhagavatam is going to relieve you from all anxiety, you might wonder a little bit. But it does. But especially when you hear the purports of Prabhupada, which are actually a combination of beautiful compilation of the purports of previous acharyas, then we become pacified. So there's a lot to go through, and I don't know how much I can make through it, but let's see what we can manage. So in the purport to verse 12, Prabhupada talks about how the sahajiyas, they don't like to hear these topics. Does anybody know what a sahajiya is? I'll explain that. A sahajiya is a person who takes the teachings of the Bhagavatam cheaply. Do you know about the rasa dance already? How Krishna dances with the gopis? No. So there's a very intimate pastime in the 10th canto where Krishna interacts he's on the altar with the gopis, and there's a beautiful description of his intimate dealings with the gopis. So people who take the scriptures cheaply, they say, oh, we don't want to hear about all this violence. We want to hear about Krishna's intimate pastime with the gopis. They usually like to smoke marijuana and also engage in illicit sexual activities. So that's why sahajiyism is not approved. So Prabhupada speaks in this purport. He says all the topics of the... Maybe it's worth reading the purport a little bit. Lord Krishna is so kind to the fallen souls that he personally incarnates himself amongst the different kinds of living entities and takes part with them in daily activities. Any historical fact, old or new, which has a connection with the activities of the Lord is to be understood as a transcendental narration of the Lord. Without Krishna, all the supplementary literatures like the Puranas and Mahabharata are simply stories or historical facts, but with Krishna they become transcendental. And when we hear of them, we are at once become transcendentally related with the Lord. Srimad Bhagavatam is also a Purana, but the special significance of this Purana is that the activities of the Lord are central and not just supplementary historical facts. Srimad Bhagavatam is thus recommended by Lord Sri Krishna Chaitanya Mahaprabhu as the spotless Purana. There is a class of less intelligent devotees of the Bhagavat Purana who desire to relish at once the activities of the Lord narrated in the 10th canto without first understanding the primary cantos. They are under the false impression that the other cantos are not concerned with Krishna. And thus, more foolishly than intelligently, they take to the reading of the 10th canto. These readers are specifically told herein that the other cantos of the Bhagavatam are as important as the 10th canto. No one should try to go into the matters of the 10th canto without having thoroughly understood the purport of the other 9 cantos. Krishna and his pure devotees, like the Pandavas, are on the same plane. Krishna is not without his devotees of all rasas. And the pure devotees, like the Pandavas, are not without Krishna. The devotees and the Lord are interlinked, and they cannot be separated. Therefore, talks about them are all Krishna Katha, or topics of the Lord. Oh, slow down. Okay. So this purport is talking against this sahajya tendency. And we're reminded that Krishna doesn't only have conjugal rasa, he has rasa with all of his devotees. So if you want to be a cowherd boy, Krishna won't forget you. And the point is that we shouldn't try to apply material perspectives to spiritual subject matters. And even more encouraging is that we should all know that everyone has something to offer in the Sankirtan movement. So even if we're not very elevated, we can still make our little offering. And there's the famous story, of course, of Lord Ramachandra. When the bridge was being built, a little spider wanted to help build that bridge. And Hanuman was telling him, "What can you do?" And Ramachandra was quite strong with him. "His service is as valuable to me as yours." So that was from verse 12. And then in verse 13 and 14, Prabhupada reminds us that the subjects of the Bhagavatam are so important that every Indian, he said, everyone who is born in India or has become a devotee in the Krishna consciousness movement is required to spread this message of the Bhagavad all over the world for the benefit of the world. You know that verse? Bharate Vimate Hoila Manushya Janma Ja Janma Sataka Kori Para Upakar, right? That anyone who's taken birth in the holy land of India must make his life perfect, and he must also preach mercifully the message of the Bhagavad all over the world. Yeah, Prabhupada says here. Lord Chaitanya desired that all who are born in India seriously understand such Krishna Katha, and then after full realization, preach the transcendental message to everyone in all parts of the world. And Prabhupada didn't expect that from us, though. He says, whatever we knew, he didn't wait for us to become perfect. He would have had to wait a long time. Instead, he gave the process of preaching as our means for becoming perfect. And then in verses 16, we hear about how the 6 aggressors have to be punished. Who remembers who the 6 aggressors are that have to be punished even by death? One who sets fire to the house. Attacks the family, yeah. Attacks with deadly weapons, yes. Yeah, who feeds poison? Pardon me, steals the wife? Kills children? He takes your land, yeah. So we have to keep in mind that actually the Kurus did all that to the Pandavas. They tried to steal their wife. Everything that they could have done that deserved them to be punished, that made them deserving of punishment, they had done. So it was necessary for Ashvatthama to be punished. And then we hear also that although Ashvatthama was born in the family of a Brahmin, he could no longer be considered a Brahmana. Who knows of an analogy that Prabhupada gives in this regard? You don't automatically become a Brahmana because you're born in the family of a Brahmana. Doctor or a high court judge, just because you're born in the family of a high court judge or a doctor, doesn't mean you automatically become a doctor. You have to take the training. You can't just walk in and start operating someone and say, you know, my father's the doctor here, so I'm going to do this operation now. It doesn't work like that. So similarly, this idea that the caste system is very a very degraded representation of the original creation in which the Lord gave different living entities different capacities. Now it's all by birth, but Krishna said not by birth, but by quality and work. And of course we hear in verse 22 of Arjuna's prayers, which are, Prabhupada said that Arjuna was an intimate friend of the Lord, and in practice he didn't have to really pray like that, but he did it to set the example for us. I guess Arjuna also did it out of his natural devotion for the Lord. I just try to understand logistically how he could get that many prayers in. I guess Krishna could hold that weapon until Arjuna finished his prayers. Yeah, he even went around Krishna and the whole thing. I guess he had to get off the chariot. Quite amazing. And then we hear in verse 27 about the subtle science of chanting hymns. So the hymns that were chanted in order to invoke the Brahmastra weapon, they were very subtle, and they were related to spiritual chanting of hymns, but they're not, Prabhupada said they're not spiritual. Of course, they're much more effective than the hymns, or than the mechanical way in which nuclear weapons are cast today. And they're more precise. They don't destroy everything. Although this particular weapon that Ashvatthama had set out was very dangerous because he didn't know how to call it back. So if one knows the science, as we'll see later, that Ashvatthama, one could say it was a mistake of Draupadi to let Ashvatthama go free, because later he tried to kill the only surviving member of the Pandava family who was in the womb of Uttara. But of course, these are the kind of mistakes that great saintly persons make. Sometimes people who got a little bitter after leaving the movement, they talked about Prabhupada's mistakes. But we all know that the only mistake that Prabhupada made is that he took the risk of preaching to people like us. And that knowing that some of us might not be able to understand it and later on have some problems. But what could he do? That was the only hope for our survival is that he preached to us. Our spiritual survival, and probably for many of us, our material survival as well. So these are the mistakes of the great devotees. And so Arjuna, the idea is that these subtle signs of chanting hymns are much more effective and actually much more dangerous. And then later on, in verse 32, Srila Prabhupada talks about how today there's so much predictions about the end of the world. We heard it was coming on December 12th, but it's been postponed. So much because of technical difficulties. So you've heard of this thing called millennialism, right? Where the world is always being predicted. The world will end. But remember, my daughter was asking me about this. Mom, do you think the world will end soon? I said, well, according to our scriptures, it won't end for another 427,000 years. She goes, okay. There's a lot of things that I decided. She decided that she wouldn't. That wasn't necessary to do. She wasn't in such a hurry anymore. The thing is, people who don't have knowledge, even they laugh at these predictions, but because they don't have knowledge, they also become a little bit nervous. But Prabhupada says in the purport of text 32 that it's only according to the Lord's will that the world will end. No material, they can maybe wreak some damage, and that's only because they have the karma to do it, but they can't destroy the world. That the world can only be destroyed because when Krishna wants it to be. Yes, and then in verse 37, there's this discussion about the death sentence. We shall go there. Verse 37. Read a little something what Prabhupada says about a life for a life is just punishment for a person who cruelly and shamelessly lives at the cost of another's life. Political morality is to punish a person by a death sentence in order to save a cruel person from going to hell. That a murderer is condemned to a death sentence by the state is good for the culprit, because in his next life he will not have to suffer for his act of murder. Such a death sentence for the murderers is the lowest possible punishment offered to him. He's getting off easy. And it is said in the Smriti Shastras that men who were punished by the king on the principle of a life for a life are purified of all their sins, so much so that they may be eligible for being promoted to the planets of heaven. According to Manu, the great author of civic codes and religious principles, even the killer of an animal is to be considered a murderer because animal food is never meant for the civilized man. And Prabhupada goes, he develops that everyone involved in this whole chain is implicated in karmic reactions, and that animal killing by Vedic sacrifice was never meant to encourage animal killing, but to limit it. So back to this idea of the death sentence. I remember when I read an article one time, a long time ago, when I was living in Canada, and it was called Grief. The name of the article was Grief Beyond Bearing. So one mother had lost two of her daughters to a vicious murder in her own living room. Some guy that they'd been associating with didn't like that they gave up his association, and he killed them in a very terrible way in her own living room. Of course, she wasn't there when she came home to find this. So, but I was reflecting that if those girls, they may have just been implicated just because they were in the material world, but if they had been implicated from murder from a previous life, they wouldn't have had to go through this, and neither would the mother. So that we see that the death sentence is actually a benefit to everyone. So I would just like to just have a short, a small discussion. What is the problem with the death sentence these days? Why is it that it would be problematic to have a death sentence more often now? Yes? Pardon me? Yes. Yes. Yes, because there's unqualified people making the judgments, many times the person who isn't the actual murderer gets killed. So that's the problem. And that's the main problem. But other than that, the death sentence is necessary and beneficial. Anybody else have any thoughts on that? Yes. Of a jury, you mean? There'd have to be something like Bhaktivinod Thakur. Remember, Bhaktivinod Thakur was a judge. And what took other judges days to assess and to decide concerning the people who were being brought to court took him a few hours. You have to have a certain kind of spiritual vision. Yes, Mark? Say it again. Yeah, I mean, I have to admit, I don't really have an answer, a clear answer for that. It's just that we accept that the death sentence is necessary and beneficial, but unless persons are qualified. Prabhupada Bhaktivinoda Thakur himself said there should be, that the high court judge should be wearing tilak. So unless devotees ourselves become very advanced and we're able to spread Krishna consciousness very strongly, the death sentence will always be a little iffy. You mean in scripture? In court. So sometimes people quote against the death sentence, you say. Yeah, they're misinformed. They don't understand how... They only think in terms of this immediate life, but they don't understand the big picture. It's like sometimes when I was visiting my family and I was talking to my aunt, and she said she didn't understand why there's so much suffering in our family. And I said, but she said, she asked me how I dealt with it. I said, well, because of my lifestyle and because of the knowledge that I've been exposed to, I have a bigger picture. And oh, God love you. Oh, God love you. She didn't believe in God. But she could immediately recognize that if you have more knowledge, then you can cope with things better. And what to speak if you're actually a person trained according to Vaishnava and Vedic standards, how to make assessments in this particular very difficult situation, then your making mistakes will be much less, if minimized to zero. So the only qualification to be able to have the death sentence given full power is if the people who are judging are qualified. For the time being, of course, we're all relieved when we know that some serial killer has been removed from the scene for his good and for everybody else's. But it's still going on, more than we maybe would even like to know, that innocent people are being killed. Or maybe not so innocent ultimately, but... Mahalakshmi, dear, you want to say something? Yeah. Exactly. Yes. It's a problem, serious problem. It's a problem. He wanted us to preach to the mass and to the class, right? He wanted us to do grassroots preaching, and he also wanted us to try to, he used to say, capture some high person in a high post. We had to capture quite a few, I would imagine. So, in other words, the work of the Krishna consciousness movement is far from finished. So when we hear about this kind of topics, then we realize there's a lot of work to be done. Yes, Prabhu. Yes. Yes. Yes, I agree with you on that. Those in very obvious cases, the death sentence or life imprisonment is the minimum that can happen. Just because of one's personal inability to control his senses, that he has to be implicated in killing somebody else. And the karmic chain just goes on and on and on. And there's no material benefit, there's no spiritual benefit. It's just an endless chain of misery. Yes. Yeah, but the thing is, in ordering a society, you can't afford to think like that. You can't think, oh, well, you know. No, you have to, someone has to take some responsibility. And that's where the administrators have a very huge responsibility, and they have to be advised by qualified brahmanas. Because it's an endless chain of, if you think it's all karma, well, what to do? No, we have to. That is the responsibility of a Krishna-conscious government. Okay, we don't have much time left, so I just want to quickly touch... Actually, we don't have any time left, but I don't want to... The class did start a little bit late. I just want to touch on a couple of topics before we close down. There's the controversial topic of... In verse 43, Prabhupada talks about Draupadi's lack of discrimination. Yeah, in 43, he talks about how Draupadi, that women as a class are no better than boys. Very interesting. In the Bhagavad Gita, Prabhupada at first says that Arjuna is a very nice devotee, and that's why he's so compassionate. And later on, in another Prabhupada, he's even called cowardly. So here he's first of all glorifying Draupadi, and then later on, criticizing Draupadi, and then later on he's glorifying her. I would imagine that he's just interweaving different commentaries of different... I wouldn't say imagine, an educated guess, but that he's using different commentaries of different acharyas at different times to make different points. So in verse 43, he says, it's verse 42. Okay. Here it is. Ashwatthama was condemned by the Lord, and he was treated by Arjuna just like a culprit, not like the son of a brahmana or teacher. But when he was brought before Srimati Draupadi, she, although bereaved for the murder of her sons, and although the murderer was present before her, could not withdraw due respect generally offered to a brahmana. This is due to her mild nature as a woman. Women as a class are no better than boys, and therefore they have no discriminatory power like that of a man. Ashwatthama proved himself to be an unworthy son of Dronacharya, or of a brahmana, and for this reason he was condemned by the greatest authority, Lord Sri Krishna. And yet a mild woman could not withdraw her natural courtesy for a brahmana. Even to date, in a Hindu family, a woman shows proper respect to the Brahmana caste, however fallen and heinous a Brahma Bandhu may be. But the men have begun to protest against Brahma Bandhus who are born in families of good Brahmanas, but by action are less than Shudras. The specific word used in this sloka are Vama Swabhava, mild and gentle by nature. A good man or woman accepts anything very easily, but a man of average intelligence does not do so. But anyway, we should not give up our reason and discriminatory power just to be gentle. One must have good discriminatory power to judge a thing on its merit. We should not follow the mild nature of a woman and thereby accept that which is not genuine. Ashwatthama may be respected by a good-hearted woman, but he does not mean that, but that does not mean that he is as good as a genuine brahmana. So some interesting points being made there. But later on, Prabhupada said that Draupadi's judgment was glorious, and even Yudhisthira and others agreed with her. What I understand is her thought process became more developed, and only Bhima and Krishna were more or less in opposition with her. So it's very interesting that among devotees, and even between Krishna and devotees, there's some room for individuality, and... that point was brought out. Yes, and then we hear about Draupadi's compassion between verses 43 and 47. Actually, I almost cry every time I read that. It's so touching to the heart. She's so grief-stricken, and still she can think about the mother of Ashwatthama. Very, very much touches the heart. And then we hear about the perplexities in solving the problem and what to do with Ashwatthama. And Arjuna solved it very nicely. If he hadn't let Ashwatthama go, the story, the Leela would not have been so developed. So ultimately, it's all Krishna's Leela, and we may have our different opinions about how it should be done, but Krishna had a Leela that he wanted enacted. So this is as much as I could glean, and I hope that you get some satisfaction from it. The next section, we'll be hearing about the prayers of Queen Kunti, and Ashwatthama will make his entrance again. Ashwatthama, as far as I understand, is still hanging around in Vrindavan somewhere in a kind of shadowy form. And anybody that has the fortune to be able to see him thinks, yuck. And Shiva Ramar has incorporated that in one of his books. Obviously, he's read it somewhere in one of the Vaishnava Shastras. that Sari and Sukha are talking, and she's going, "Who's that creep?" And he's going, "Shh, Krishna lets him be here. He's allowed to be here. You be quiet." You know, husband and wife discussion. And apparently in the next, the next kalpa, he will be one of the seven Maruts or something like that. So he's not an ordinary person. He has been engaged in Krishna's lila and doing terrible things. So I was also meditating when everybody was speaking very badly about the person who killed all those kids. I thought, but he's also, not that it was anything right about what he'd done, but he was a soul. He's a soul. And what he's implicated in now is so abominable. So Krishna didn't forget that Ashwatthama was a soul, and Krishna engaged Ashwatthama in this way, and now Ashwatthama is getting purified, living a very obscure and horrible existence, although he gets to be in Vrindavan, but as not a very welcome person there. So there's hope for all of us. If Ashwatthama is getting the mercy of the Lord, then we all can get the mercy of the Lord. So thank you all for listening patiently. Sorry for any mistakes or offenses I might have made. Hare Krishna.